summarizing where we are at this point. So we actually learned from the discussion in previous lectures that you have something like principle of equivalence, and that allowed us actually to identify that gravity is geometry, right? So from the principle of equivalence, we know that gravity is geometry. And as you know, the geometry is described by a metric. So this is described by G mu nu. And together with Einstein, we are trying to build a field theory, classical field theory, for this field G mu nu. So G mu nu is now a field, and we are trying to build a classical field theory. So now we know that each classical field theory consists of three parts. So first, you need to identify the field, which we did. It's our G mu nu. Then you need to identify what are your equations of motion in that field. So if you have a particle, so classical field theory consists of particles and fields. So now you need equations for both, for particles and for the fields. So provided I know the field, then in order to know how the particle behaves in that field, I need equations of motion. So this is d square x mu d tau square plus blah, 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 there's this gamma u u equals to 0. So that's one equation which we need. And we already have that. So equivalence principle actually allowed us to construct this thing. And the final thing, we need field equations. Field equations. So we need to know how, provided we know the distribution of the matter, the distribution of particles, and so on, how, well, which fields are created, how they are created. Okay, and so this is difficult. And for this, we need to really understand, so need to understand the geometry. And so it basically took Einstein 10 years to understand this, right? So he, you know, realized based on equivalence principle, this was quite soon. That was simple for him, right? He had that in 1908, probably. But he needed to, in order to construct the field equations, he really needed to learn Riemannian geometry. And that was not part of, you know, physics education in that time. So he had to ask his friend, mathematician, to actually teach him geometry and so on. And it was a very painful experience. And it really took him 10 years to understand this. And he was very frustrated. If you read his letters, you know, he was almost ready to give up. And really, it took him 10 years to understand that and to construct Einstein equations. It will take us approximately till next Tuesday or Wednesday to do this. Okay, so this is where we are. And so first step in understanding the geometry, we need to understand what the manifolds are. What the manifolds are. And I gave you a formal definition yesterday. But basically, what it says is that manifold, let me be very vague. So manifold is made of pieces that look like open subsets. Well, it's almost a definition, but it's vague, of R to the N, which are smoothly sewn together. So if you had that picture yesterday, I'll draw it again. So you have your manifold M. This is your manifold M. Then I pick up an arbitrary point there, and for each such point, I'll find a set or a subset of that manifold where actually this belongs to. So this is O alpha. And then for each point, there is at least one of these subsets, so that each point is covered by subsets there. So for that point, there'll be another subset and so on. Okay? And so from this subset, there is a map, psi alpha, which goes to the R to the N, and displays this subset to some open subset of R to the N, U alpha. Okay, so there'll be an image of point P will be, let's say, here. Okay, so that is that. So now this map must be very nice. So it must be one-to-one. So if I have one point here, I must have one point there. It must be onto, which means that everything here is covered, right? There are no holes in my problem. And if I have two subsets here, O beta, and there is some overlap, so there is now another map, psi beta, which will be again to R to the N, U beta, that will be my image of point P, for example. Then if I have this overlap there, then you want that this is tuned together smoothly, meaning that the map from here to there will be smooth, infinitely many times differentiable. So what is that map? So I first have to go back to the manifold. So it's psi beta 2 minus 1. Then I'm in the manifold, and the map is psi alpha. So this guy is a map from R to the N to R to the N, and it must be nice and smooth. So that's the definition of the manifold. OK, so this is C infinity. That's right. So I think if it's one to one and onto, then it has an inverse, and then you can go the other way around. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So now some terminology. So psi alpha has two names. So it is called chart by mathematicians. And and coordinate system by physicists. Okay. So probably Neil will use both terms. So it's the same thing. It's this psi alpha here. And sometimes, if physicists, they would just write x mu instead of psi alpha, right? So now, if you have the collection of maps, meaning that I have collection of the subsets O alpha and the corresponding psi alpha, right? So I have the subset of the manifold O alpha, and then I have the corresponding psi alpha, and then I take all these alphas. So what is a collection of map? It's an atlas, right? Geography. So let's call atlas. Very good. So now maybe some examples. So the simplest example of a manifold is R to the N, right? You can check easily that it satisfies all the properties of the manifold. R to the N, well, there's a map to R to the N. So that's very simple. So now there is another very simple, is the sphere in n dimensions. So S to the N, so how it is defined is that you have x1 square plus x2 square plus blah, 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 plus xn plus 1 square equals to 1. And of course, it's a ball. And that's another manifold. Just, well, I'll give you as an exercise. So think about if you have S2. So exercise, if you have S2, think about how to form an atlas for that. Right? Think about if you can find these O alpha and psi alpha. And then maybe it helps you that it's usually used in complex analysis. Is this something like stereographic something? Okay, so think about how to do this, for example, for S2. So by the way, here, if I draw S2, then that's a manifold. Usually, you can think about S2 as a two-dimensional manifold, which is embedded in our three-dimensional Euclidean space. Right? So if it is a ball, I'm basically, you know, embedding it, I'm drawing it in my three-dimensional Euclidean space. But that's not generally true for manifolds. So manifolds do not have to be embedded in anything. They just exist on their own. So you don't need some higher dimensional Euclidean space or whatever to embed your manifolds. Just, you know, take the definition and that's a manifold. You don't need any embedding. You don't need any higher dimensional spaces. There are theorems of embeddings that I think, what is the theorem? Have you seen the movie Beautiful Mind? So that's the guy who actually did these embedding theorems. It's this crazy mathematician, schizophrenic. So he proved that, you know, if you take Euclidean space which is of high enough dimensionality, you can embed into it any manifold. But it's not important for us, right? So you know, don't think about manifolds as embedded in something. It's better to think about manifolds on their own. Okay, so that's another example. Yep. No. Of course not. Of course not. I can choose whatever I want. Yeah. So think about the simplest atlas, or yeah.
And in general, you cannot embed R to the N plus one.
You can easily embed R to the N.
Okay, so one more example of a manifold, let me draw it here, is a torus. So for example, T2. So what does it mean is take a sheet of paper and now identify this guy with that guy and this guy with that guy. So I first curl it like that and then I curl it like that and I create a torus. So this gives you a torus. And that's another example of a manifold, right? Okay, but there are also examples of which are not manifolds. So for example, consider, this is a stupid example, but anyway. So consider a wall or a sheet, and then suddenly from that sheet, you have a line, right? You have a chord. So together, this will not be a manifold because obviously this guy is one-dimensional, that guy is two-dimensional. So if you glue them together, they cannot form one manifold here. Or another example, which is more interesting, is that if I have a cone, then again, so the surface of the cone is two-dimensional in general, but I see a problem here. So this will be a problem. This point will be a problem. Why? This is not a manifold. Okay, so these are examples when you don't have a manifold. So now you can... Well, first of all, it's not differentiable there.
Right, but then you are talking about differentiable manifolds.
And second of all, what is the dimensionality of here? Well, of the point there, right? It's not probably two-dimensional, right? So it's something, it's something weird. So you know, go through the definition and you'll find that something is weird.
So if you take the cone and take out that point,
then you would have two manifolds, exactly. So if I have one cone, I see a problem here. But you can either treat this as a manifold with boundary, so I just smooth it out around that point. Yeah, so if you remove that point, then it's fine.
Okay, and yeah. Another thing that you already wrote it for, embedding the manifold in some RN somehow it has properties induced by the fact that you embed it in RN. I mean, you take, for example, the metric on the torus.
Well, that's how you find the metric on the torus, exactly.
By embedding it on
but, yeah, that's one way. Yeah. But yeah.
Can you not find the metric independently, like without embedding it?
Well, here, what he's talking about is basically I know how to measure distances in my Euclidean space. So now I embed into that Euclidean space some surface or something like that. And then on that surface, there will be an induced metric. It's called induced metric,
yeah,
which is basically given by the metric in the Euclidean space, but now restricted to my surface. Okay, so it's basically metric given by my Euclidean metric. But of course, I have a manifold, and I can prescribe on it any metric I want, right? So it doesn't need to be an induced metric from some background, which I have there. Yeah, so it's.
So I can see that if you had psi alpha being non-differentiable, you could end up with a point or a crease or something. But is the constraint that this composition has to be C infinity just about consistency of your parameterizations or your maps from Euclidean space to the manifold as opposed to something about the manifold itself?
I don't understand the question precisely, but
I guess what I'm saying is what objects would you include if you only required the individual maps to be infinitely differentiable as opposed to these maps?
If there were no the smooth sewing.
Yeah.
Without the smooth sewing, it's not meaningful for them to be infinitely for them to be differentiable. Like the differentiable is individually you can't have the differentiable map to something that doesn't already have this manifold structure that isn't Rn. Because it's just a collection.
You know, it would be something more general, but however, the question is, does it have any significance, right? So it would be definitely something more general. Let me actually elaborate a little bit on this. Well, not really, but so if you are in GR, and you have particles and blah, 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 you need these smooth manifolds. GR makes sense only on these manifolds. So you need the smoothness, precisely what you are basically asking. But if you have some other theories, for example, you have string theory. So in string theory, you don't really need manifolds because strings are one-dimensional objects, and then they don't really mind some singularities and some. They wouldn't mind that tip of the cone. They would just smooth it out because the string is extended object. It doesn't make sense to talk about how it behaves at a point. So in string theory, you don't need manifolds. You don't need that smoothness, and you need, for example, so people usually do strings on so-called orbifolds. And you will learn about these in your string theory course, right? But these are basically more general objects. They are not manifolds. They don't have the smoothness. The simplest orbifold is that you consider a line, and you identify, so there's zero here, and you identify x is minus x. So you identify this point is that point. So x is identified as minus x. It's the simplest orbifold. So everything is fine except zero, where zero is identified with zero again, right? So there is some singularity, okay? And then so this is a simple example of an orbifold. This is called R1 divided by Z2 orbifold. And string theory works, you know, string theoreticians, the calculations on orbifolds are very simple. So that's why they do that. And so there are more general things than manifolds. And this is one of them, yeah. Okay. So let me continue. So with manifolds. So we are doing GR. A map F, which goes from M to M prime. So you can consider a map which goes from one manifold to another manifold. So let me draw a picture. So we have one manifold M here. We have another manifold M prime here. is this map F. And again, so what does it mean is that there is some psi going to 1 r to the n, and there is another psi prime going to the r to the n. And so basically how you define F is how these points here transform to those points there, right? And so how you do that, so I have to, so if I'm going from here to there, then I have to go against this one, so it's psi minus 1. Then I am at some point here on the manifold. Then I map it through F, right? And then I have to go down, so psi prime. So this is the map between, again, r to the n, r to the n. And then you require usually that, again, this map is C infinity or whatever, that it has some nice properties.
So basically, any operation that you're familiar with, and you can do it in a manifold just by going back.
Yeah, yeah, because you have this nice smooth mapping from the manifold to your r to the n. So now a definition. So if F m to the m prime is C infinity, 1 to the 1, and onto. Onto means that you cover all the points in the image. So, okay, so for example, if a function, I don't know, say a function of x, so this guy is not onto because I don't cover
image set are covered, right?
the whole images, yeah. So this is not onto, that guy is onto because it covers the whole y axis. So it's onto and has also C infinity inverse. I don't know if that is not already implied. Maybe it is. Doesn't matter. Then F is called, it's a very important name, diffeomorphism. Okay. And so now diffeomorphic manifolds which means if there exists a diffeomorphism between them, have the same manifold structure. Whatever intuition behind this, you can imagine. Okay. I don't know what isomorphism is, but yeah. Isomorphism probably preserves the length or something like that. Is that what you mean?
Like when you have two different groups, but their group structure is the same, then you can draw an isomorphism between them.
You need your isomorphism to be by this.
Yeah.
In that case, and be a normal morphism.
If you must, if your morphism is an isomorphism on the category of an
that doesn't help.
The point is that precisely what you're asking.
You're saying two manifolds are diffeomorphic if they're, the map F is defined over the whole manifold, right? So locally I can do that operation of
F is defined on the whole manifold, but of course I have different covers of that manifold.
Right.
Yeah, but I know how to sew these together, right?
Okay, so you can only, the notion of defining a function on the manifold is just local, right? For each chart, I can do this. So when you say that two manifolds are diffeomorphic, is that function is defined in all of the possible charts?
The function goes from the whole manifold to the whole manifold. Yeah, it's global function, mm-hmm. And I can always define it through these local charts or local. Yeah. Okay, so now we have the stage for general relativity, right? Manifolds are the stage where everything is going to be played, right? So now, what are our actors? So tensors, or if you want, invariant objects, are actors on our stage. So manifold is the stage, these are the actors. So the simplest thing is, let's start with a scalar, which is basically a special case of what that guy is. So a scalar function f is a map. It's a map which goes from the manifold to R1. Okay. So let me draw again a picture. So I have my manifold M. This is too high. Then let's imagine I have again two overlapping subsets, O and O prime. O prime, and then I have a map from O prime. Let me do it in physics of X prime coordinate system R to the N. And here I will have X to the R to the N, right? And then there's some function F which goes to the line R, right? So now what I, of course, require is that independent of my parametrization, independent of which coordinate system I choose, the value of the function must be the same, right? So what I require is that f x of p equals to f prime x prime of p. Or how physicists would write it is f prime of x prime equals to f of x. Okay, so the value is the same thing. So doesn't matter if I don't talk about here, I can go back to the point P, right? And then I display that point by FP, so I get a number, 5. It doesn't matter if I use a different coordinate system. But anyway, so my image of P will always return me back to the same point P, right? And then I display it with this F. So it's just, you know, using different coordinate system, but it has to give me the same number, right? Yes?
The reason you have a prime on the F, are you saying that the functional dependence of...
Yeah. Now I'm looking at it from a different coordinate system, so I put a prime.
Okay. So the point is that it just, if you were to not depend the prime, then that would mean it has the same functional dependence on X prime to X.
So if I did write F of x prime equals to f of x, well, it's okay. So here, okay. So here, if I write x prime, I'm talking about the same point. I'm talking about this point here, and that will have some x, and that will have some x prime here. So I'm talking about the same point here. This guy is the same point as that guy, just expressed in a different coordinate system. Okay. So now if I did write that, what it means is that the value of x prime is different than the value of x, right? So if I change my coordinate system, the value will be different. First I assign x to be 5. Now I move 5 meters back, so x prime will be 10, right? So the value here is different than the value there. So if you did write that, then you would say that the function at 10 is the same as function at 5. Which is, of course, not what you want. You want that the function evaluated at the same point here is the same. So this will be something else.
And it also allows the algebraic EFI and
Okay, so we have scale function. That's good. So now something more complicated. We want a tangent vector. And the simplest thing to when you are thinking about vectors is actually directional derivatives. So this is a direction of a derivative. I'll explain why. Direction of a derivative at a point. So if you think about r to the n and your experience from there, so in r to the n, you know that if you choose some coordinate system for a vector, then your vector has some components v1, v2, vn, right? So this is in specific coordinate system I choose, let's say Cartesian coordinates, and I measure my vector how much in x direction, how much in y direction. So I choose some directions, and these are the components of the vector in that direction. So now what you can do is that to any vector, you can in a one-to-one way prescribe a directional derivative. Derivative operator, if you want. Directional derivative operator. So you define an operator v hat to be v mu t over dx mu. Right? So you start with the vector, and then you do any vector, you write an operator v hat. So what does it do? So such thing will act on functions. So v hat acts on functions. So this is a function. And it just gives me a number, v mu df over dx mu, which is a number, right? For each x, it will be a number. So basically, to any vector, you can assign an operator which acts on functions and gives a number. And this is a concept which can be generalized to arbitrary manifold. Okay, so let me just say, so if I have, for example, vector which has only the first component non-trivial and all the others are zero. So if I have, for example, only v1. So what this guy tells me is that how that function is changing in the x direction, right? This will be only how it is changing in the x direction. If I choose second component, how it is changing in the y direction. So basically, if I have x1 and x2, then you can assign vectors in which the function is changing to be these. D over dx1, d over dx2 are basically directions in which I'm trying to change my function. Okay. So now what is the specific? So now you want to generalize this to the manifold. But what is characteristic about this operator? This operator, I'll be using that definition basically in the manifold for the vector. But what is characteristic about this operator? Well, it's a differential operator, which means it satisfies Leibniz rule. Right, that's first property. And second property, it is linear. And it is linear. So this is basically everything I will require for my vector. So that it acts like this differential operator which you define there, and it is linear operator. So now form a definition. So let. Yeah, really mathematicians. No, it's really bad. Once you say let, it's bad. So anyway, so let F be the collection of C infinity scalar functions. On M. So now we know what the scale function is. So let's this be an arbitrary. Basically, let this be the whole collection of all possible functions on my manifold. Then a tangent vector tangent vector, let's call it V, at point P, is a map which is a map V from this space of functions to the real numbers, right? This is what I am having in mind, which satisfies first it is linear, so what I mean by that is that if I have f acting on two functions f and g, possibly multiplied by some number, so a and b are numbers, are real numbers, f and g are functions, so then you know that if you differentiate number, you can always take it outside of the derivative because the derivative is zero. So I can take this a out, so it's a times b of f plus b times v of g. Okay, so that's linearity, so a and b are real numbers here. And second, Leibniz. Which means that if you have v acting on a product of two functions, then it's v of f times g at p and g of f, v of g times f at p. Okay, yes.
I have the notion of a tangent vector when I have a curve, right?
When you have?
When I have a curve.
Okay, that's another possibility how to do that, yeah.
But I never seen it in, like, that the tangent vector acts like a derivative or something like that.
Okay, so very good, very good. That's very good that you ask. I'm not going to do it this way. But you will see that in a continuation of this relativity course after Christmas, you will see it introduced as a tangent vector to a curve, and then it will be proved that it's the same thing. Okay, so I don't want to do that. It's usually it's another possibility how to define a tangent vector, that you imagine that you have a curve. At one point, you choose a tangent vector to that curve, and then you look at the properties of that. That's a different definition. But of course, So. In our approach, that would be a theorem which you could prove, or you can start with this tangent vector and then prove that, you know, this will be a theorem, right? Okay, whatever. So this is our definition at this point. It's the same thing. Yeah. Wait till Christmas. Okay. So we have definition. So now we have a theorem, right? Once we have definition, we have a theorem, which I'm not going to prove. Because the proof is relatively lengthy, but you can read it in bold. So the set of tangent vectors at P forms now a new term, a tangent vector space. We have tangent vector, so that's why we have tangent vector space. Forms a tangent vector space you know, the fact that it's a vector space, now it's trivial because we have linearity and everything. So it immediately follows from our definition that we have tangent vector space. This is denoted by TPM. So M is our manifold at point P, and T stands for tangent. So tangent vector space, this is how it is denoted, which has, now this is a non-trivial part, which has the same dimensionality, same dimensionality as M. So if I have n-dimensional manifold, my tangent vector space will be n-dimensional. Okay. With the And that, now I'm talking about coordinate, but doesn't matter. So if you don't like that coordinate, just forget about that. Coordinate basis, d over dx mu. So basically, where we are. So in that picture, d over dx1 was the direction, in basically along the x1 direction, along the x1 axis. So this will be a basis in my tangent space, d over dx1, d over dx2, and so on. So any vector, what is a consequence is that any vector can be expressed as a linear combination of my basis vectors, right? So as V equals to d mu d over dx mu. And if you want, this is proved in Vault, page 15, 16. One page proof. If you start with the definition I gave you, then that this is true. Okay, so these guys are my bases, and this is just a linear combination of the bases, so that I form a vector, or an arbitrary vector. Right? So if I still think about R to the N, then d over dx1 tells me I want to change my function in that direction, and v1, so this tells me that which direction I'm changing my function, and how big that is how many times I'm changing along that direction. So if I go 1, I change that. If I go 2, I change twice, like that. So it's an expansion in that basis. So these are called components. Components, and this is basis of that vector. So now a picture. So if I have, for example, my sphere, so this is S2, I consider a point here, then you can think about the tangent space. So this is my point P. You can consider tangent space to be a flat sheet, TPM. And now I can choose some coordinates. So this will be one direction d over dx1. This will be another direction d over dx2. And then I can, any vector is just expressed as components in this basis here. OK. So that's good.
Are all the tangent spaces on a manifold diffeomorphic?
Yes. That's right. Yeah. You can think about them like a same space, basically. Yes. Yeah. So now that really our definition gives a number, just to check. So V acting on any function of F is V mu d over dx mu. And now how you define that, so F is again defined through this chart. So it's F composed is psi minus 1, if you want, and this is evaluated at psi of P. And if you draw a picture, you will see that this is just a real number. So now very important thing, is that V is an invariant object on the manifold, right? So it is there no matter what. Now I can describe it in two different coordinate systems, right? For example, a rotating system or a static system, which means I am changing the basis vectors, right, in my system. So d over dx1 will be different in one system and in another system, right? But what it means is that actually I have to measure different components of that vector in these two different systems, right? Because the total vector v is invariant object. It's simply a vector, right? But I'm describing it in two different systems. So v is an invariant thing, but I can either describe it in coordinate system x, then I have that.
What you're calling here x is basically psi, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So where? How can I interpret what you have there? You have ddx mu and f for both.
Okay. So here, this d over dx mu is a derivative in my r to the n.
Right, but that depends on which chart you're in, right?
Exactly. So I choose one chart.
You call the coordinates x.
Yeah, so in that chart, I will have an image which will be in coordinates x, right? So I choose one chart, and then I'm going from that chart. So this will be a function of x, basically. So I start this x, map that x back to the manifold, right? And then map from the manifold by function f. Well, think about it.
I don't understand why you have a
I had a picture before, right? Where is it? This one here, exactly. So now what I'm doing here is that I am...
X and X prime are basically working as psi.
So this is very vague, right? So there's some map psi into this. So I map this point P into this that point there in R to the N, and I assign to that point some x, right? I assign some values of x. I assign x1 and x2 to this point x.
Wait, okay, you have your point in your manifold, and you use x or x prime to map that point into Rn.
That's right. Well, no, you have a map from the manifold to Rn, right? And then I assign to that point by this map some x1, x2, and x3, whatever.
So you're going from Rn back to your manifold with psi inverse and then apply f on it and then depend.
So I guess I'm a little bit confused with this notation you have here. I think that right. I mean, you're saying that p is mapped to x by psi, so like psi of p is x.
That's right, yeah. So you can think about it, this psi has some indices mu, so psi mu of p is x mu, basically. Yeah. Okay, so now this is very important. So look at this. So I can either express this vector v in the coordinate basis x, or I can treat x as a function of x prime. Okay, so what it means is that I write this one, v mu of x, still the same thing. But now I use the chain rule to express this in terms of the x prime. Okay, so this is d x prime nu over dx mu d over dx nu prime. Right, so I'm changing from x coordinate system to x prime coordinate system. Very good. So now this was my basis in the original system. Now this is the basis in the new coordinate system. Exactly. So what it means is that this guy must be v nu prime. It must be the components of the vector in a new coordinate system. Right?
Okay.
X prime. Thank you. Perfect. So this is very important. So transformation of components of the vector is given by v nu prime at x prime equals to dx prime nu over dx mu v mu of x. This is how vector components do transform. And you can check that if you have Lorentz transformation, if x prime and x are connected with the Lorentz transformation, and this will just be lambda nu mu, which you already know. right? How the vectors transform in special relativity. So this is important for your homework. So when you are asked to transform your electromagnetic field, electromagnetic potential A mu, from one reference frame to another, then it's not enough to actually rewrite x in terms of x prime, but you also have to multiply by this matrix nu mu, right? So you have to do both. You have to transform x to x prime, just rewriting x to x prime, and then multiplying by the matrix here. Okay. Oh no, we are running out of time. So now, so far, what we have done is we talked about this vector space at a given point P in the manifold, right? So we chose one point P in the manifold and constructed this vector space above that point, this tangent vector space at P. So now we can extend this, so extend the construction, to the whole manifold. Okay. And so you introduced a new notion. Which is called, so now let's use the same letter B, but now this will be tangent vector we had before, tangent vector. But what we had before was tangent vector at point P. So now if you consider all points P in the manifold, then this is called a field. So tangent vector field. So the field is important now. So tangent vector field. And it's basically a collection of V at every point P. Okay, so now I have my manifold like that. I considered vector at one point P here. So that was my vector here, which of course doesn't live in the manifold. It lives in this tangent space. Then I have another one here, another one there, and blah, blah, blah. So now I want to join them. I want to talk about all of them together at one point. So they define some vector field on the whole manifold. The flow of water everywhere in the manifold with the velocity something, right? So for all p, m. But of course, I want that this is somehow smooth. That it's not possible that at one point it goes that direction and the next point it goes opposite direction. So it must be somehow smooth. But how do I make it smooth? So I require that v of f, which is a number. So vector is a thing which for a function gives a number. So this is actually sufficiently smooth. So it's a smooth map. Smooth map. So then it guarantees that my vector field will be smooth. Right? So for any function f, this is for any function f. For all f. Okay, so now, yeah? So I define vector at each point P,
yeah.
Right? So at each point P, to any function f, I have, so VP of f is a number, right? So now I consider a different P, let's say P prime. It gives me another number. So in the end, actually, this guy here, V of f, where I consider all P, will be a function, right? Function on the manifold, right? It gives me different numbers for different points on the manifold.
So is V, when you say V of f is smooth, does that mean evaluating the entire field on f?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. So this is some kind of function. So for one P, it will be one number. For another P, it will be another number. So this is a function on the manifold M. And I require that this function is smooth. Okay, the last definition before the break. So the set of all TPM meaning I consider all possible p. So we had, so these are tangent vectors at point p, tangent vector spaces at point p. So now I consider all p together. So I have set all of all these tangent spaces. And this is called tangent bundle. T of m, as denoted by T of m. So I have one vector space. So here's the picture, this picture here, this picture here. So I have my manifold m, and then I make TPM, which is, so I choose a point p here and make a tangent space towards that p. So now I consider a different p and make another tangent space here. Right, and so now I go through all the points in the manifold, and I consider all these tangent spaces together, and this is called tangent bundle, the set of all these tangent spaces in the manifold.
One question: in each point you define a tangent space, so in each point you have different tangent spaces, right, with different tangent vectors.
Yeah.
How can you relate one tangent vector in this tangent space with this?
That's a very good question, and it will be explained on Monday.
Okay. My question goes: what is? I mean, if there are different spaces,
yeah.
What is the point on unifying all the tangent spaces?
Andreas,
it's called parallel transport, and it will be explained probably on Monday, because I will not have time to do it. Let's have 3 minutes break and start at 10:02 or something like that.
All the tangent spaces are isomorphic to each other. Why do we need a tangent bundle?
Which are combined.
This is the way.
So this guy actually, he, but this guy,
yeah.
L.
Okay, so maybe let us start. So now we have a definition of the tangent vector, and we know what the tangent vector is. So, and tangent vector field is. So now there is another object which is called cotangent vector, which is basically a similar thing, but not really. Cotangent vector. So now you understand why it took 10 years for Einstein to understand all these things. The cotangent vector, or also a one form, and this is called, usually you use different letters for that, so you use omega. So again, let me start at a point. So cotangent vector at a point is a map. So it's a map which for any vector in the tangent space assigns a number. So what does it mean is that if you've seen that it's basically omega belongs to the dual space of TPM. So okay, so for any vector I assign a number. That's what omega is. Okay. And so again, I told you there are very similar objects to tangent vectors. So they form a now so-called cotangent space, cotangent vector space. Cotangent vector space. And that's denoted by TP star of M. It's a dual space to a tangent space. And we had a theorem, so I'll just write it here very quickly. So with the basis dx mu, whatever that means. Okay, so we had basis d over dx mu for vectors. Now we have basis dx mu for a covector. And this is defined, this basis, by requirement that dx mu over d over dx nu equals to delta mu nu. Okay, so a covector is something which takes a vector and produces a number. So in particular, it takes this basis of a vector. So if I define new vector v, which is, well, whatever. It's a special vector, right? So now I act with this covector on the special vector, and I get a number. And I define the basis so that this number is 1 if they are the same or 0 if they are not. OK. I'm not claiming it's a total. It will be total differential. It would need to be proved. Yeah. At this point, it's just a notation. But I'll be using that it's actually a total differential. Well, but again, you can read the proof if you want involved. So now, can write omega to be omega mu dx mu. So again, it's a linear combination of my basis vectors. My basis vectors are dx mu, and these are just the numbers, right? Just the components of that covector. Components. And this is the basis. So now I'll be using what you are doing. So what you asked, but I'll not prove that. So now changing coordinates again. So I write my omega as omega mu dx mu. Which is omega mu, and now I express this in different coordinates and use the fact that it's a differential.
But actually, I mean, you define dx mu as how it acts on the partial differential, the partial derivative, right? So you don't need to say that these sort of differential to see how it transforms under change of coordinates, right?
So basically, so you define this guy. Well, so what is this guy here? This is delta mu, right?
All right. If you make a change of coordinates to the partial differential, then we can use what we used before, and that defines another vector in the cotangent space, right? Which transforms as you're going to show, right? Without using that, it's a total difference.
That's right. Well. Doesn't matter. Don't care about the logic, how we define this at this point. You know, it can be all done very precisely, very consistently. I'm just trying to explain the concept of what you are doing here. But yeah. So anyway, so now I use that this is a differential, basically. So it's dx mu over dx nu prime dx nu prime. OK. So again, this is a new basis here, and these are my new components, right? So what does it mean? So this is omega nu prime at x prime. So we have a transformation relation that omega nu prime x prime is dx mu over dx mu prime omega mu of x. So you see, what is our formula? Do we still have it? Nope. Ah, there you go. It's lurking there. So you see that the covector and the normal vector, they transform basically in the same way, but the matrix is now the inverse matrix of what we had before. So for the vectors, we have x prime on the top, and for the covector, we have x prime in the bottom. Right? So they transform in by inverse thing. So this is an inverse. Okay. Very good. So now, you know, for a physicist, all this geometry in the end, when you are doing practically general relativity, is not very important. What is important is these transformation properties. So if you don't like the geometrical picture behind what vector is, what covector is, and so on, then just remember how they transform, how the components transform, and that's enough. So you know, don't be bothered by this deep mass, and just remember the transformation properties. So more generally now, a tensor of type K and L, tensor of type K and L, is a multilinear map T, which goes from TP star times TP star, blah, 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 times TP star, K times TP times TP, L times. Okay, so it's a map which basically for vectors which live here and for covectors which live there gives a number. So it's a beast. You feed L vectors to it and you feed K covectors to it, and it gives you a number. Okay, but more practically, it's an object which will have. So now, for each vector, I will have one index. For each covector, I will have one index. So this will be a beast which has many indices like that, many indices like that, and these indices transform in a certain way. So if you have alpha, beta indices, gamma, and blah blah blah, and there is k of them, and then you have indices down, mu, nu, and blah, 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 and that is L of them, and X prime. Then, so I have T prime at X prime, T prime at X prime, so this is how it looks like in my new coordinates. Then these indices transform like vectors, and these indices transform like covectors. Okay, so which means that I have dx prime alpha over dx, let's say, delta, and blah, 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 and there is k of these. And then I have, let's say, dx iota over dx prime mu, and blah, 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 and there is L of those. And then here I have t delta and blah, 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 and iota blah, 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 at x. Right? So this is how you transform a general tensor. Yeah? Don't laugh. OK. Yeah, laugh is good. So
you define the components of your convention with downstairs index, right? Is that convention? Or?
Sorry? You can?
You define your omega? Omega mu has a downstream index.
Index down, yeah.
Okay, so
and you see that it is a different object than the vector in general.
Right, you define the components of the vector with the upper
yeah, index. Yeah, so you define vector with components up, and you define covector with index down. But you see they are completely different objects. This guy has this basis, d over dx mu. That guy has d over dx, dx mu basis. So they are different objects in general. But once you have a metric, you can actually, there is a one-to-one map from vectors to covectors if you have a metric. But if you don't have a metric, these are completely different objects.
So that's the meaning of raising and lowering means this is basically going from covectors to vectors.
Sorry? Go.
Raising and lowering means this is.
Yeah, exactly. So once, for raising or lowering indices, you need a metric, right? So in general, it may happen that you don't have a metric. So in geometry, it may happen that you don't have a metric. Then these objects are completely different. But once you have a metric, there is basically a map from vectors to covectors. Okay? So again, if you don't like all that math we have done, just, you know, remember this transformation rule. That's all you will need. So now, cookbook, tensor algebra. Yeah. So let T and S are tensors. Then, well, you can add them because everything is linear, right? So T plus S is a tensor as long as they have same valence. They are of the same type. They have K is the same for both of them, and L is the same. So same valence. So I can add them. I can take a product. So I can put, you know, T alpha beta, well, T alpha, blah, 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 and then gamma, blah, 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 S beta, blah, 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 delta, blah, blah, blah. So now I can treat this object as a new tensor, which will have indices alpha, beta, gamma, delta, right? So this is, again, tensor. If you want, this is a tensor product between two tensors. So I take a tensor product of these things. I'm just putting alpha, beta indices, gamma, delta indices. So contraction. So OK, this is a tensor product. And everything is fine. So now you have contraction. Sorry? No, I'm saying that if you. So this will form a tensor which has indices alpha, beta, gamma, delta. You know, so if you take these two tensors, then it gives you another tensor.
And the other tensor will have rank sum of.
Yeah, it will have k plus k prime and l plus l prime.
Yeah.
So okay, tensor. This is a tensor of the rank k plus k prime and l plus l prime. Okay, so now we can do a contraction. So I have, for example, t alpha, beta, and blah, blah, blah. And then I have s alpha, gamma, and blah, blah, blah. And there may be blah, blah, blah here as well. I don't care how many blahs are there. So anyway, so this index is the same as that index here, which means that in the end, so this index is just sum over. What it means is that index is sum over. So it is not in the end in that expression. So this is a, so this gives you rank. Okay. K plus K prime minus one and L plus L prime minus one tensor. This is a tensor. Well, that index simply disappears because you sum over that. It's the same for velocity u mu, you contract these and you have objects which doesn't have any indices. And then trivial but very important property, I really like to stress that if tensor 0 in one coordinate system, packet, then it is zero in all coordinate systems. So it comes from the fact that tensor is an invariant object. So if I can, you know, I see that in one coordinate system, all its components are zero, you know, then no matter how I transform them, they will be zero in all other coordinate systems because it is a zero tensor.
But
it's nothing to measure.
You mean invariant with respect to some form of transform?
Sorry?
You mean, so when you say it's invariant under some transformation, it has to be invariant under some form of transformation. Is it, are they invariant under any transformation?
I am doing transformation of coordinates here, for example. Right, so it can be any transformation of coordinates.
Okay.
So then this thing transforms like this, but you observe that if all the components here are zero in one coordinate system, then all the components on the left will be also zero. It's a very important property. It's trivial from this point of view, right?
Yeah.
But realize this, think about it, you know, it's very strong, actually. Yes. Okay.
And position tensor of the origin will be 0, 0, 0. Then if you move the origin, it might be 0.
The answer is that the position tensor is in the tensor.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe, well, do you want to hear about connection or not really? It will be another 10 minutes. No connection. You can leave it on for Monday. For Monday. Connection? Who wants to hear about connection?
I always want to hear about
connection. Okay. Oh, no. They'll be very angry with me. Okay. So now we have tensors. So we have actors. We have the stage. So now we want to formulate our physics. And in order to formulate our physics, we need to know how to take derivatives. Because you know that most physical laws are expressed in terms of differential equations. So you need to know how to take derivatives. So connection. Connection, so we express laws of physics. Physics. As differential equations. Differential equations. So we need to define how to actually take a derivative of a tensor. So need to define derivative of a tensor. Okay. So that's the whole thing. That's the whole goal. So now you can check easily that if you have a scale function phi, then d mu, the partial derivative of phi at x, is actually a tensor of rank 1 and 0, 0 and 1. So you can easily check this by the chain rule that this really transforms as you want. Okay. However, if you want d mu prime of a vector, then what it is, it's d x mu prime over, so now I use my transformation property of the vector, okay, which is d x prime alpha d x nu a nu. V nu. Okay. So now I have to use the Leibniz rule on these two terms. So I'll write it down. So this is
the left hand side is the left is d by dx.
Mu prime. Yeah. Okay, so this is d over dx mu prime. Yeah. So I'm taking a derivative of a vector in new coordinate system, and I'm looking, does it transform as it's supposed to transform, right? So this statement is that this is equal to dx nu, dx, now I choose another coordinate, dx beta, dx prime mu, v nu beta. So I have differentiated it, that term here. And then I differentiate the first one. So it's dx beta over dx prime mu, d square x prime alpha over dx beta, dx nu, and v nu. I differentiate the first one. So it's just the chain rule, and I'm writing everything in the same coordinate system. OK. So this guy here is absolutely fine, right? Because if this is a new tensor 1-1, then the first part transforms as a covector, the second part transforms as a vector. Can you give us 5 minutes, please? Then the first term is okay. So okay for 1-1 tensor. Right? This will be fine. This is precisely how this is my transformation property I want, and this is fine. However, this one is a problem, right? So in particular, you can check that if I use, for example, Cartesian coordinates, right, then if I differentiate, this guy here will be 0. So if it's 0, so if it were a tensor and there's 0 in one coordinate system, it would have to be 0 in another coordinate system. But it is not true, right? So in one coordinate system, it is 0 in Cartesian coordinates. In spherical coordinates, it won't be 0, right? So this is a problem. It's not a tensor, not a tensor. Whatever. So this is really a problem. So how to upgrade that? And there are very nice invariant definitions of the connection. But for us at this point, the simplest one is that so here comes on the stage Riemann in 1830, and it's actually his PhD problem. So it's a PhD problem, how to define a covariant derivative, or how to define a derivative of a tensor, so we get a tensor again. Okay, and so he says, well, it's very simple. So define an upgraded derivative of a tensor, of a vector, so nabla mu on v nu, which is what you would naively do. So you take a partial derivative of that, but you know that the partial derivative doesn't behave properly because of that second term. So then you put simply an object that something is wrong, V alpha, and you require that this object behaves like a tensor. So it behaves like a 1-1 tensor. It transforms like a 1-1 tensor. You know how this transforms. So this gives you how that guy must transform. So this guy is called connection. It is not necessarily what you have seen Christopher symbols in two lectures ago. It is something more general at this point. The whole thing is called covariant derivative. So now you require that this is transforms like 1-1 tensor. So you want that. This transforms like 1-1 tensor. And it gives you how. So gamma prime transforms in the way that if you have alpha prime, mu prime, beta prime, So from there, you need to know how the, well, you can infer how gamma transforms, right? So this is the first thing. So this would be fine. Gamma would be a tensor if it transformed like that. But there is an additional term. It's minus d square of x alpha prime over d x alpha dx beta. And there is an additional term which actually causes that gamma is not a tensor. Okay, so the logic is I want this guy to be a tensor. I know how that transforms. So from here I can actually learn how this guy transforms. And this is my prescription. So gamma will be called connection anytime it transforms in this way.
Any object that has this transformation property.
It's called connection, exactly. And it's not a tensor because of the second term. It's not a tensor. Okay. So that's great. So there are some consistency conditions which actually Riemann discussed in his PhD thesis, but it's not important for us. So any object which transforms in this way is a connection. It's called connection. So similarly, you can define a covariant derivative for an object with index down, which is the partial derivative of the index down minus gamma gamma beta alpha omega gamma. And it's the same object there. Sorry. Okay. Two last minutes.
The covariant derivative applied to the covariant vector gives you a scalar, but over there, when you apply it to co-vector, you get a zero blue tensor.
Yeah. So here, I want that the left-hand side transform as 0-2 tensor, exactly. Right. You want that the left-hand side transforms as 0-2 tensor?
Yes.
Yeah, and then yeah. If you construct it like that, and gamma transforms in this way, then it is guaranteed that it is true. Okay, so more generally, you can do for any tensor. So you have index beta here, and index gamma here. Then this is d alpha, d gamma, and beta, and then you for each index which is up. You transform in one way, and for each index which is down, you transform the other way. Okay, so this is plus gamma gamma delta alpha t beta delta, and then minus gamma rho alpha beta beta alpha t gamma rho. Okay, so you are just basically applying the same rule, but now to each index separately. Okay, last thing I wanted to tell you is that if you actually antisymmetrize the indices of the connection, which is so definition, this is 1/2 gamma alpha beta gamma minus gamma alpha gamma beta, then you can show that this guy actually is a tensor. So, you know, use the transformation property for the one, use the transformation property for the second one, and you find out that this guy is a tensor. And it's called, so this is by definition minus 1/2 t alpha beta gamma. And this tensor, so it's a tensor, and it's called torsion. It's called torsion. So in GR, torsion is set by hand equal to 0. Right, so Einstein said there is no torsion. We don't need torsion, right? But if you have some, you know, some more advanced theories, something like supergravity, string theory, and blah blah blah, then actually torsion is non-zero there. So whenever you have spin particles with spin, they create torsion. basically. So GR torsion is equal to zero by assumption, but if you have some higher theories like string theories, supergravity, and blah, 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 then torsion is non-zero, and the source for that is spin. So if you have particles with spin, fermions, and stuff like that, then just a second, then you have non-zero torsion. So one thing I want to really stress is that in order to define covariant derivative and this connection and everything, you don't need metric at all, right? So we haven't used anywhere in the metric. We just defined covariant derivative requiring that this guy transforms as a tensor, and that gave us the property how the gamma must transform. And so we didn't need metric anywhere. Once you have metric, you can actually write down more explicit expression for this gamma. And that will be done on Monday. Right? So but to define covariant derivative, you don't need metric.
So okay, that formula for the covariant derivative with the dual vector, should that be alpha beta, and then alpha beta, or is that
right? Sure. Yeah. Sorry. Alpha beta. Yeah.
Oh, but since torsion zero, the gamma is symmetric in the lower frequencies?
At this point, I define it in this way. Okay. And if the torsion is zero, it is symmetric.
Yeah. Define beta.
Yeah. I just define beta alpha. I hope it's correct. It's up to a sign. So if you have, it's an alternating sign. So you have plus here.
The way it transformation for the connection.
I think it's minus, yeah.
It is. Should be a minus two max.
Yeah.